time to tell me the truth, to burden your mouth for what you say, and pieces of paper in the way, 'cause I can't continue pretending to choose these opposite sides on which we fall. Loving you later.
You're listening to Between the Lines on WGXC at 90.7 FM, community radio for Greene and Columbia counties. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper. Halloween's coming up, so my show today is all about our deepest fears and what scares us, something my guest, famed horror writer Jack Ketchum, the man Stephen King called probably the scariest guy in America, knows a lot about. Giving a talk in anticipation of Halloween entitled Talking Scars, Turning Your Fears into Fiction at the B.T. Powers Place in Catskill, New York on Saturday, October 27th at 5 p.m. Jack Ketchum is a pseudonym for Dallas Mayer, a former actor, singer, teacher, literary agent, lumber salesman and soda jerk. This former flower child and baby boomer was mentored by Robert Bloch, the author of Psycho, and he acted as an agent for author Henry Miller, the experience of which forms a chapter in Ketchum's memoir, Book of Souls. Ketchum is the author of 11 novels, the latest of which are Red, Ladies' Night and The Lost. Many of his books have been made into movies, such as The Girl Next Door, The Woman and Lost. He's the recipient of 4 Bram Stoker Awards, and in 2011, he received the World Horror Convention Grandmaster Award. One reviewer described his brand of horror as unsettling and brutal, and he has been described as having a straightforward, blunt approach which chills the soul. He's going to read an excerpt from his latest work, a pair of linked novellas called I'm Not Sam, which he co-wrote with writer and director Lucky McKee.
Now I'm way beyond confusion. Now I'm scared. I've slid down the rabbit hole, and what's down there is dark and serious. This is not play acting or some waking bad dream she's having. She's changed, somehow overnight. I don't know how I know this, but I sense it as surely as I sense my own skin. This is not Sam, my Sam. Wholly sane and firmly balanced. Capable of tying off an artery as neatly as you thread a belt through the loops of your jeans. And now I'm shivering, too. In some fundamental way, she's changed.
Oof! I've got the shivers already.
Oh, good.
That's the point, right? Yeah. You know, Stephen King has often quoted another writer for stating that horror fiction is for those of us who like to stop and look at car accidents. Do you agree with that? I mean, what do you think is the role of horror?
I think that Doug Winter, who's a really good writer and critic, said once that horror is not a genre, it's an emotion. It's like love or fear or anxiety or any of those things that we actually process internally. It's on the shelves, it's put along with mysteries or science fiction, but really it differs from that because we feel horror if we see it, if it incurs into our life. And what we're doing writing this stuff is essaying what might happen to you. And it might not be some monster interfering with your life. It could be going bankrupt. It could be losing the love of your life. It could be anything that engenders a sense of great loss and fear and horror. I think writing this stuff, it gives you a great bully pulpit, because if you engage the reader in a good, good story, you can get lots of things in there about what you feel about life, what you feel the dangers are in life, whether it's from jihad to emphysema. All those things are involved in the sense, a sense of loss and a sense of possible horror.
So really, that sort of answered the question, what makes a good horror story? In essence, it's what appeals to your own fears.
Yeah, exactly. There was a really good, years ago, there was a really good anthology that Jeff Gelb did called Fear Itself. And his innovation on that one was to get a bunch of horror writers together and say, okay, forget about scaring somebody else. What really screws you up? What really messes you up? Write that. And so he got a group of really wonderful short stories from a very diverse group of people, including Joyce Carol Oates, many people. And it was basically about that. I raised my sort of metaphorical hand and said, how about snakes? I've been scared of snakes since I was a kid. So I got to write this really cool story about snakes. But it's really what really we as human beings encounter in our lives that really scares us. Bankruptcy can scare you. Healthcare can scare you. And I write about all those things. Some of my stuff is pretty quiet. I think I'm known for the louder stuff and the more in-your-face stuff, but I kind of like those quieter, more subtle moments as well.
Stephen King, as I said, called you probably the scariest guy in America.
I sent him a book called Joyride way back, because that was in 40,000 copy hell. I couldn't seem to get out of that print run. And my friend Phil Nutman knew him and said, the guy eats books for breakfast, maybe he's read you. And it turned, so I wrote him a sort of half-funny, half-serious letter, saying, would you like to look at this book? And he said, absolutely, I've been reading you since off-season, my first book. And he said, I can write you a blurb that will make the blind men see and the dead walk. And he did. And he's been on my side ever since. He's been great. He's a very generous old guy.
Yeah, and I will finish his quote, which is that no writer who has read him, i.e. you, can help being influenced by him, and no general reader who runs across his work can easily forget him. Which is both...
It doesn't get a lot better than that, does it?
Exactly, yeah. You write about some very cruel events. In your book, The Girl Next Door, which was made into a film and was based on real-life events, two sisters are kept in a basement and basically tortured to death by the family looking after them. I mean, are you commenting on mankind's capacity for cruelty here? Is there a social message or a subtext here?
Of course there is. Yeah, of course there is. I think part of my goal as a person writing this kind of stuff is to identify the bad guys and essay who they are and give you a caution to watch out for them, and then figure out in my own heart what part of them is me, what part of their victims are me, and contrast and compare them. So that basically what I'm trying to do is try to show you what's good in men and women and how they can be destroyed and how fragile we are, and at the same time how we can resist it. The Girl Next Door is known, it's based on a very gruesome real tale. But in fact, my heroine, who does in fact, I'll spoil it, die at the end, is a real heroine. She saves her sister from a likewise fate. And I think that that's more than anything else what I'm essaying there. That and the fact that there's incredible guilt on the part of this one boy. He tries at the last minute to do something about it, but he can't. It's too late. He's waited too long. And I think that's the poignancy of it, and that's maybe why it's lasted. It's had a lot of legs. It's amazing. I get letters from this all the time. From people who've been abused, And sometimes that's positive and sometimes it's very negative because I've touched a bell there. But I want to touch the bell there. That's what I do. That's what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to make you feel this stuff and not just read it for fun.
Yeah. I saw the film quite a while ago, but it's always stayed with me because it was just such a horrific tale. And I want to ask you about another of your stories, the short story, The Rifle, in which I don't want to give the, you know, really what happens, but it's basically a mother discovers something so horrific about her troubled 10-year-old son that she basically decides to blow him away with a loaded shotgun that she's discovered belongs...
You just did give it away.
Well, the thing is that it's out there.
My lady friend and I once had a conversation, and I think we'd been watching something on television where mom and dad were talking about how what a nice son he was and how could he possibly do this stuff. And he was a miserable monster. And we were talking about it, and I said, you know, if they had known about this early enough, they should have just blown him away. And that's what The Rifle is. The Rifle is a woman discovers that her son has done awful, awful things, and realizes what he is, knows that all the clues are there. He's tortured small animals. He's set fires. He's done the entire profile. And she decides to take him out. It's been my second most reprinted story, and I think, it hits a nerve somewhere.
But does this have any kind of wider social implications? Again, when we're in the age of Columbine and the recent massacre in the movie theater in Colorado, is there any kind of lesson to be drawn here?
Well, I hope so. I hope I write from a moral point of view. I don't advocate moms taking their kids out because they suspect them of being bad guys. That's not really what I'm advocating here. But if the clues are clear, they should at least be reported, turned in, and because I'm writing fiction, I can make that bigger. I can make that I could go for the extreme, and that's what The Rifle does, because she does in fact kill her own son. And I don't mind doing the spoiler on that because hell, it's a short story, and I think it's engaging enough, even if you know what the ending is. So, I think that we all, as writers, should have a bigger agenda than just entertainment. Entertainment's fine and dandy, but if you're writing something and you've got an audience, you've got a bully pulpit here. Use it. Talk about what concerns you and what issues and social issues and what personality defects and how you love. Write about that. Write about love. Write about, you know, what the absence of love does and what positive things love does. And if you don't want to do that, why do it in the first place? It's never been for me about making money. It's never been for me about just telling stories. I've always tried to, get down how I feel about the world and people.
And indeed, for some people, the absence of love is as big a horror as anything else, or the thought of the absence of love is horrific.
Malcolm Lowry, No se puede vivir sin amor. It is not possible to live without love. It's from Under the Volcano.
You base
for your Spanish readers out there.
Right. Okay. You base some of your, much of your writing on real-life incidents. Are they easier to adapt to fiction than using your imagination and making things up?
Say that again?
I said that you base some of your writing on real-life incidents.
Oh, yeah.
Is that is that easier to adapt to writing? Is that easier to write about than just using your imagination and making things up? And which is scarier?
You are making things up. You're always making things up, whether you're writing from a reality-based point of view or not. I've always felt that, with a few exceptions, I'm not really that scared or that worried by the supernatural world. I don't really think too much about demons and vampires and stuff. I wrote one vampire story, which is like 5 pages long, and that's all I have to say about vampires for the rest of my life. But what we do to one another, what people do to one another, that's what scares me, and that's what I really want to essay. So that's where my stuff comes from. I don't think you can write any fiction without engaging your own imagination and digging into your own psyche and seeing what's down there. There are just people who write supernatural fiction a whole lot better than I do. So I leave that to them. I leave it to the Stephen Kings, and I've written one novel called She Wakes, which is a supernatural-based thing. And I like it because it's set in Greece. And when I was in Greece, and many times I've been in Greece, I always felt that there was a lot of supernatural power there, some sort of, not supernatural exactly, but some sort of spiritual power there. And so I wanted to write about that. And that, apart from a couple of ghost stories, is about all I have to say about the supernatural world. No, it's what you and I may do to one another. And, you know, the guy on the street who looks like a nice, okay guy who's got a kid in the basement, you know, that's what really screws me up.
Well, that kind of answers my next question, which was, what scares you, and has it evolved and changed over the years?
You scare me, Anne, because I don't know you.
Oh, I'm very nice.
For all I know, you've got this lovely British accent, but you could have the kid in the basement. I don't know.
Absolutely true. That's
so,
absolutely
you know,
true.
You're the one I'm wary about. No offense.
But are there any actual physical things out there that scare you?
Snakes. I'm afraid of heights. I can't stand on the bridge of a building for too long before I start thinking, gee, I may just jump or fall. Most things that scare a lot of people don't scare me. I love forests at night.
Mm-hmm.
I love lonely, quiet places.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really feel threatened by them. I've been living in New York City for a long, long time, and I've learned how to handle New York City, and so New York doesn't scare me anymore, though it seems to scare most of the visitors who come here. I don't have too many phobias. As I said, it's mostly snakes and heights and human beings.
Okay.
Not in that order.
Okay.
Can
And if you've just joined us, you're listening to Between the Lines on WGXC at 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Anne Forbes-Cooper. And in honour of Halloween, we are talking with horror writer Jack Ketchum, author of some bone-chilling fiction, including The Woman, The Lost and The Girl Next Door. Jack, how do you keep your imagination fertile? How do you keep it active? Are there ways to kind of invigorate it? Are there ways to... How do you keep coming up with new things?
I think once you start doing this, it becomes second nature. You'll be listening to some conversation on a street corner, and you'll pick out a line. Or you'll be in a bar and hear a story, and you'll say, gee, I can make that story to a story that I've heard before, and maybe to a third one, and then maybe on those three I've got a story, a full-fledged plot. So it's just keeping your antenna out, which I think if you've been doing this for a long time, you just automatically do. I know I did it when I was a little kid. I've been going through a bunch of notes that go way back to the 70s, and I'm finding stories that still resonate with me now. I may pull some of those out and play with them again. Those were files that I had long since forgotten even existed. It's like pulling out a book of snapshots and except it's literature, so you're going, oh, here's a snapshot of your mind at 20. Here's a snapshot of your mind at 45. It's kind of fun to look at and see who you were way back then. So, yeah, it's all grist for the mill, Anne. You know, you'll see a movie, you'll take an idea from a movie or something that you see in a newspaper. Yeah, it's a matter of just keeping open to the subjects.
Is there anything that... you wouldn't write about? Do you have your limits?
Yes and no. I think I know when to put on the skids. In The Girl Next Door, there's a chapter, which is actually one line. It says, I don't want to tell you about this. Something about the effect, I don't want to tell you about this, and that's the end of the chapter. And I think that the stylistic approach more than anything else. I sort of knew that if I'd gone into that particular incident, I would have approached pornography, so I decided, nah, cut that. Let people imagine that, and then I go back to it as a non-observer a little bit later in the book. But there's this book that I'd like to write, maybe a novel, maybe a novella, that I've been finding really hard to even deal with. It deals with animal cruelty, and I know the story. I'd like to write it. But I don't know if I want to live with that subject matter for 6 to 8 months. Because when you entertain this dark stuff, it's there with you, and you can go out and party, and you can play around, and you can see your friends. But when you come back to the computer at the end of the beginning of the day, that's what's facing you. And I'm not really sure I'm ready to write that. I think it's an important story, and I think I should write it. But right now I'm chicken.
This brings me on to about five different things. One of them, you live in a very dark place a lot of the time. You're writing about some horrific incidents. What is your world like? I mean, are you sort of a well-balanced, fun-loving, sunny, optimistic person?
My world is pretty light, actually. I've got two cats, a well-loved a partner who I've been with for many, many years. I go out every day and see my friends at my local Cheers bar. People tend to like seeing me at these conventions and stuff, and I love seeing them. I'm a pretty happy camper. I think you have to remember also that what I said before, yeah, I write dark stuff. I proceed from a very dark place, but I also write a lot about what's important and what's love. And so being able to examine that, it makes me examine that in my personal life as well. I know who my friends are. I know who my lovers are. Most of the people I've loved in my life are still in my life, and I'm very proud of that and very happy with that. Life is good.
Okay.
And I'm making money at this, too. It's cool.
That has to be a great compensatory factor as well.
And I get, and I get great responses from readers.
Mm-hmm.
I get that all the time. The Girl Next Door has gotten me death threats, and it's gotten me letters say, I was an abused kid. Thank you for writing this. It doesn't get a whole lot better than that. And screw the people who want to shoot you.
You mentioned kind of porn. I mean, in horror, porn is a whole sort of subgenre all of itself, all in its own, I gather. But that's not an area you would ever go into.
Oh, I know. I had my fling with porn. When I was starting as a writer, I was writing for all these men's magazines back in the late 70s, early 80s, and what they all wanted to be was Playboy. So it was really kind of cool back then because you could write pretty much anything you wanted to write, real stories, real reportage, as long as it had a sex angle. But this is before, the major porn magazines came out, before Hustler, etc.
Mm-hmm.
They all wanted to have like this well-rounded men's mag kind of attitude. And so I wrote a lot of stuff for them. Actually, they kept me alive for about 3 years. And so I dipped into that. And it was fun to do. Mostly I did satiric black comedy kinds of things. And it's great fun. If you want to check out that part of my writing, find a book called Broken on the Wheel of Sex. It's still in print, and you can get it from Overlook Connection Press. And that's my men's mag period. But straight out porn, it doesn't really interest me.
Mm-hmm.
It's like looking at silicone boobs. Nah.
How has your writing evolved over the years?
Oh, well, don't forget I started pretty young. I think I first wanted to be Henry Miller, and then I wanted to be Samuel Beckett and Harold Pinter, because I was writing plays. I finally realized I had written this book, which I think wanted to be the air-conditioned nightmare, Henry Miller's book, about a cross-country trip that Paula and I had taken. I must have rewritten it a dozen times. And finally, Paula, bless her heart, said, "Hey, you're supposed to be such a hot writer, sell something." So I said, "Well, you, I will." So I said, "Okay, I will." So I wrote this story, and I sold it to Swank magazine for $150, and it was like, bang. It's like, okay, I really now have my own voice. I'm not Henry Miller. So I took all copies of that thing, brought them to my mom's house, and burned them in her fireplace, and felt free as a bird. you got to kill your children to get on in the world and get on to what you really are.
Yeah,
so.
kill your darlings. Yeah.
I wanted to be a poet. I wanted to be a dramatist. I wanted to be all that stuff. So.
So what attracted you to horror?
I was a kid. I was always attracted to horror from the early Universal movies, Frankenstein, Dracula, The Mummy, all that stuff. I watched late at night. Don't forget, I'm of a certain age. And then the Hammer films, Horror of Dracula, Curse of Frankenstein, whatever, and then the big bug films, them, it, all that, all those things. And I used to go to Saturday matinees and be thrilled by them. And then when I finally decided to quit my job as an agent, a literary agent, and write for myself, I was working the initial first 3 years with men's magazines, with rock and roll magazines, with whoever would have me. I wrote for Classic, decorating and home crafts and stuff, whatever. I have been watching the new crop of horror films, which included things like Night of the Living Dead and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the early Cronenberg films, all that stuff that was pretty much in your face and pretty innovative for that. And at the same time, Stephen King was there, Peter Straub was there, Ira Levin, all these guys who are writing really cool, good horror novels. And I thought, gee, I haven't read a really great horror novel since like Dracula and Jekyll and Hyde, except for these guys are just pulling it out of their hat over and over again. I could name lots of people, James Herbert in England, Graham Masterton's early books. And I said, this is an interesting niche, and I think because of the horror movies, they're actually clicking. But what they're not doing is they're not showing you all the stuff that's not throwing in your face like the movies are doing. And even Stephen King Peter Straub would pull away a little bit at the last hour. And I thought, maybe there's my innovation. Maybe I'll just like do a Texas Chainsaw Massacre and put it in prose form so that you feel every single moment of it. And it's in almost simulated real time. You know, there's no breaks in the time and the action. And so that was my innovation. That was my idea for off season. And once I did that, I was hooked. I had a great time writing that.
You grew up in New Jersey. Did
yep.
you have a happy childhood? What did your parents do?
My mom and dad, I'm a World War II brat. I was born in 1946. My father, on the GI Bill, bought a home in Lewiston, New Jersey, which at the time was a rural area that was just becoming turned over into a suburban area. And he bought a store called the Sugar Bowl, which was a confectionery store. Okay, I have to explain confectionery store. Confectionery stores in those days, they mostly don't exist anymore. The word was confection, which meant candy or sweets. But basically, they sold newspapers, magazines, books, over-the-counter drugs, toys. They had a counter, a soda fountain. You'd sell lunch, you'd sell breakfast, you'd sell all that stuff, homemade stuff. My mom and dad made pies and cakes and all that stuff. And I started out wrapping newspapers for them and sending them back in the morning or in the afternoon, and then became a soda jerk, word fountain, got to give a lot of free ice cream to my girlfriends.
You must have been popular.
My first job. That was happy. I was an only child from a troubled home. My mom and dad were lovely people who shouldn't have married. They were at war constantly, and so I was always felt in the middle of that. So I retreated a lot. Luckily, I had a woods behind my house. I had a brook running through the back of my house, and I had a bunch of baby boomers like me on a dead end street who I could dip into and play with or not play with according to my want. But basically, I was a loner, and I read a lot. My mom encouraged me a lot to read. She was a great reader, and at one point, the librarian said, "You can't read Ivanhoe. It's too adult for you." Mother sent her an angry phone call saying, "Of course, he can read anything he wants to read from now on in." And so I did. I didn't have a happy childhood, but looking back on it, man, a lot of people have had a lot less happy childhoods. And I did have a lot of encouragement from my mother to do what I wanted to do. She was the one who actually got me to Robert Bloch. She and my 12th grade teacher, between the two of them, and that relationship lasted until Bob died.
In 94, was it?
Yeah.
So yeah. He read your work and he was very encouraging to you.
Oh my God, he was amazing. when my mom died, I was still very much in touch with Bob, and he said, "I've got to tell you, Dallas, real name Dallas." He said, "You know, when you sent me your second letter thanking me for my first letter, she sent me a letter saying, 'My son's a bit trouble. He thinks he might want to be a writer. Would you encourage him?'" And so he did. And he didn't tell me that until my mother was dead. He kept that secret until she had died. And then he opened it up to me, and I was very touched.
That's very generous of him, considering how many wannabe writers there are out there.
He was a wonderful man. Stephen King has a lot to say about him, too. He was a great mentor to many of us.
And what about Arthur Miller? You were his agent at one time? How did that come about?
Henry Miller.
Henry Miller.
Arthur was the playwright.
Yeah, Arthur was the playwright. Henry Miller, yes.
Yeah, I was his agent for about 2.5 years, and I think I was his last agent, real agent, before he died. I sold his last book, for sure, called Book of Friends, to Kappa Press. And, Henry was great. I pulled him in because my boss, it is a long story, my boss is a bit of a pirate, and he held really great clients like Norman Mailer and Arthur C. Clarke, etc., but basically he was a pirate. And he said, "I don't want Henry Miller. Henry Miller's is all mad, and he's, you know, he's tired, he's cranky, he's going to be a pain in the ass." I said, "It's Henry Miller. He broke the censorship laws. He's a brilliant man." He said, "All right, well, you take care of him." I said, "I'll take care of him. I'll call him from home if it costs money." And I did, and Henry was great. He never caused any trouble. I just sold some books for him, and I sold some stories for him, and it was wonderful to do that, to give that back to somebody I've been reading since I was a teenager, and who was really influential in my early writing, and who educated me completely in other people's writing and in painting and art and sculpture, because he was a great appreciator of the arts. And it was just the first check I got from him was from Playboy, and it was the best check I'd ever gotten from anybody, including the one I got from myself. But to be able to send him a substantial check from Playboy magazine for this piece on him was just a total thrill. And then just before he died, I got to go and visit him for a day, and that story is chronicled much better than I can tell it now in my little book of
your memoir,
memoirs called Book of Souls. It's called Henry Miller and the Push. It's available on e-books, so, and it's cheap. So if you like checking that out, it's an easy one to do.
Okay. And if you're just joining us, you are listening to Between the Lines on WGXC. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper, and we are talking with horror writer Jack Ketchum, the author of The Woman, The Lost, and The Girl Next Door, amongst many other
books. Don't forget, I'm not Sam.
And I'm not Sam.
It's my new one.
And your new one, of course, your new one. His new one is I'm Not Sam. Jack, who is your typical reader, and do you try and attract a new audience?
Well, the common wisdom is that the people who read horror and suspense novels are largely female and middle to early to middle age. I think that's a lot of both. It may have been true once upon a time. I'm finding it's fascinating and really gratifying that I get a lot of letters and email from young people. I'm talking about people in their 20s, and even sometimes, and I'm a little worried about this, sometimes in their teens, because some of these books are not really teenage material. But it's great. The books seem to have legs, and I'm getting feedback from people of all ages and from various countries, which is really, really cool. So I don't know if I have a typical reader. I think they're good readers, because when I meet them at various cons and stuff, I've almost never met someone who wasn't articulate, literate, who didn't want to actually talk about the books, who wasn't just a fanboy or a fangirl, who was really, you know, wanted to deal with literature. It's cool.
What do you want readers to take away from your books?
Well, maybe a sense of the... I'm just going to sound pretentious. Maybe the sense of the preciousness of being human, and the importance of love, and the danger of the lack of it.
It's, I find it very interesting and very ironic that so much of your books are about horror and appalling events, and yet you're very much about love. You're saying that your books are really, this is the impression you want people to take away from them, that how important love is.
I'm not sure that there's anything else worth writing about. What do you love? You love life because it's good. You love your friend because you don't want anything to hurt them. You love your dog or your cat. And when they're put in danger, any kind of danger, your hackles go up. You go into attack mode. You go into the best you can possibly be. You try to save them. You try to preserve that. And I think that that's really all we can really do or hope to do in life is to preserve what we find important. And I put people in positions in my books and my stories where that's really hard to do. But I think if you look down beneath the surface of them, they're all in there. Somebody once told me that a reader of mine, he came up to me at a convention and he said, you know, I think all your books are really about loss. And I thought about it. And I said, what? About loss? And then I looked through, I started looking through my stuff and the themes. And he was right. It's all about loss and trying not to lose. And I think that's what he hit. He hit it right. And of course, with that, you know, with that as a base, there's plenty of things that you can overlay on that. You can overlay how it feels to lose. You can overlay how you feel, how it feels to try to not lose, to come out on top in the world in the best possible way, I mean. But yeah, it's all about, like, my God, the real fear, isn't it, is of loss, losing a loved one, losing your life, losing at the game.
After all these years of writing about mankind's capacity for evil and horror, have you formed any conclusions about how we are as people, about mankind's capacity for cruelty? Do you have a philosophy about good versus evil?
About the universe?
Yes.
Nah. Way too big. No. Stephen Hawking, thank you. I guess I have a philosophy about us. I was asked once, I thought this was almost a really dopey question, but I understand why it was asked. Do you think that we're a bit worse now than we ever were before? And I said, what? What are you talking about? Are you out of your mind? Have you read about Genghis Khan? Have you read about scorched earth policies? Have you read about, you know, what the Romans did to the Christians, or what the Christians did to the Jews? And you know, have you read about medieval tortures, Gilles de Rais? No, we're a lot better. I think we're evolving toward a better thing. I'm basically very much an optimist. I think that humankind is perfectible, and I think that part of being perfectible is realizing, for me at least, this is what I proceed to do, is realizing where we're bad, where we go wrong, and recognizing that, writing about that, talking about that. I would like to see, and I'm probably going to alienate some of your listeners right now, but I don't think we have any use for modern religion. I think it's divisive, and even in its best, most tolerant form, divides us. I would really like to see all that go away. It's not going to happen in my lifetime, but...
What is your biggest challenge in writing horror these days when you've written...
Starting. Beginning. That's always the biggest challenge. You know, you've got to get all your ducks in order and feel that you've got your characters right and your themes are correct and online. And once that's done, then you can keep on going. Once I start a piece, a long piece, I'm having a great time. But starting it sucks because there's also this insecurity about, well, is this really the thing I want to write right now, and can I pull it off and whatever. So that's the hardest part.
When do you write? What's a typical day in the life of Jack Ketchum?
There is none. I'm sort of like Travis McGee in the John D. McDonald books. If I write something long, I quit. I take an early retirement and I just stop for a little while. And I smell roses and I go. I travel. I mess around and I play too much time on the internet probably. But when I'm writing, I get up every day around 9, start working around 10, and if it's new work, if it's new pages, I can go back 4 hours tops before I go brain dead, and I've learned over the years to stop before I do that so I don't write myself in a hole for the next day. And then when I get up the next day, I rewrite what I wrote the day before so that I've got a continuity, and then I go on to the next whatever pages. I don't have any limits to pages or page count. Some days I write a lot, some days I write just, you know, a couple of pages, and I'm very happy with that. There's that. And then, you know, I take a lot of time in between. I write short stories, and those are like 4 or 5 days, and they're just like, they're like love affairs, brief love affairs, and then they pass.
How competitive is the horror market? Are there lots of writers wanting to get into it? Are there, do trends come and go?
Well, writing in general, books in general, it's really a rough market right now. I wouldn't want to be coming up in it. I try to help people who are, because it's really difficult. The book market doesn't know what it is anymore, since the e-books are coming in, the contracts have changed, and money is tight, very tight worldwide, but especially here in the States. I've had easier money coming out of it from other countries than I have here. But I think the actual competitiveness is not there at all, not that I see.
Mm-hmm.
I see this as a great big community. In fact, we help one another a lot. I see this all the time, that more established writers are constantly helping younger writers to get themselves settled in, to make sure they don't get ripped off by their contracts, by unscrupulous publishers, or by publishers just going about their business trying to make money. I think we're very, very open to one another. We want to read the next good book, goddammit. You know, we don't care about the notion that somebody might not sell us. I certainly don't. And I don't know anybody who does. The bigger you get, I mean, Stephen King, Peter Straub, all these guys are just incredibly generous people, and they keep on giving it back, because they knew that when they were coming up, somebody gave it back to them. And I think that's an ethic that we carry with us. I've not seen much to contradict that at all. Very few egos here. Few overwhelming egos here. It's really nice to see.
What are you currently working on?
I'm currently working on going broke. I'm currently working on putting together a book of poetry.
Oh, very nice.
I think I'm trying to work my way down the ladder of money. No, I was asked to do one, and it's been a great deal of fun trying to go back into my old archives and pulling out stuff that I think is still worth listening to, and slowly compiling that, and it's a great deal of fun. Lucky McKee and I are thinking about doing another project together. He's the director that I worked on The Woman with, and who I worked on I'm Not Sam with. There's a screenplay for I'm Not Sam, which Lucky has just started showing around to people. We did the book first, and that's out now, actually, in paperback, and it'll be out in hardcover limited edition and in ebook form in December. So that's available. And we've been promoting that. I just did a whole series of blog things that you can actually tune into if you go to my website, and you can get that whole trajectory of 5 blogs that are kind of fun to talk about the book and various writing subjects in general.
And your website is?
Oh, it's HTTP, whatever, .. Jack Ketchum linked, .net. Go to Jack Ketchum official website, you'll get to me.
Okay. How ambitious are you still? What are your hopes and dreams for the future?
Oh, my hopes and dreams for the future. It'd be fun to fall in love one more time. I need to adopt 2 more cats because I had 2 to die on me this year. So I needed to get 2 more cats if 2 exist, because I think 4 is a perfect number for cats. So that's in the future. And I don't know, I've led a very, very lucky, happy existence, and I just want more of the same. Thank you very much.
The event that's coming up at BT Powers, I know the title, but what exactly is the subject?
Well, some time ago I did an online class for horror writers, and some of it was nuts and bolts, and some of it was theory. And I decided what I would do is I would dump the nuts and bolts, basically, and the way we did it was you would write lectures. I'm doing this with quotes in my fingers. And they were basically essays. And then we would do assignments that were based on those lectures. And the idea was to get people to think about why you wanted to write this stuff in the first place and how to write it well. And so what I think I'm going to do is I'm going to take three of those short, 250-word pieces, string them together, read them, and then open that up to discussion. And it's basically about why we do this in the first place and you know, why we proceed from the dark side in the first place. And I hope that will be interesting enough to the audience to get some good discussion going.
Jack Ketchum, I want to thank you so very much for being on Between the Lines. And once again, your new book is I'm Not Sam, and
yep.
You have a talk, Talking Scars, Turning Your Fears into Fiction, at the BT Powers Place on Saturday, October the 27th at 5 p.m. And yep. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, you've been good. Thank you.
Okay, well, once again, thanks so much for coming on Between the Lines.
Okay, Anne, thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was my interview with Jack Ketchum. Talking Scars, Turning Your Fears into Fiction at the BT Powers Place is part of their Music, Baseball, Murder, Lunch, Fall and Spring programme, which includes the Hot Stove League, the second annual session with John Thorne, the official historian of Major League Baseball, on Sunday, November the 4th at 2 p.m. Also in that programme, Bard Beattie, the 2012-2013 season begins Sunday, November the 11th at 2 p.m. And on December the 1st, they have Pleasures of the Piano with Michael Bookman. And there's also Friends of the Beattie Powers Holiday Party on Saturday, December the 15th at 3 p.m. And you can learn all about the Beattie Powers Place at their website, beattiepowersplace.blogspot.com. I just want to thank you for listening to Between the Lines, a monthly magazine show on the third Thursday of every month. And I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper. And that was an interview I did with Jack Ketchum earlier this month. And the music you were listening to, my intro music, was Sarah Bareilles and Between the Lines. Then it was Alice Cooper singing Welcome to My Nightmare, followed by Talking Heads and Psycho Killer, and then Marilyn Manson's This Is Halloween, and you're next going to listen to Mike Oldfield's Tubular Bells, or Tububular Bells, as we used to say way back in the 70s when it first came out, and I still have the original album, I think. Anyway, once again, thanks for listening.